Pearl Harbor Day found me at the home of a girl who I was then courting, Hollis Shaw, who was a singer with Phil Spitalny's all-girl band. The telephone rang in her apartment at about 2 in the afternoon, and I was told by the service, chemical warfare service, that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor, that we were at war, and that I must catch the next train back to Washington, which I did. I caught the Congressional that day, and that was the beginning of the war for me. I spent the next 9 months as chief of the control division of the Chemical Warfare Service, a position to which I was immediately appointed upon my arrival in Washington on December 7, 1941. Having been up to that time the civilian aide to the chief of the service, I did, however, still continue as a civilian until March of 1942, when to remain a civilian was untenable, and I was inducted into the Army as a major in the Chemicals Warfare Service. By that time, my good friend General Baker had been replaced by Major General Bill Porter as chief of the service. And Bill Porter turned out to be one of the most brilliant negotiators whom I have ever met in the Army or outside in all of my life. Organizing the control division, however, in the period of 9 months, caused me to, which by the way was the worldwide administrative network for the Chemical Warfare Service, starting with myself and the secretary, and ending, as far as I was concerned, in September of 1942, with over 250 officers and other assorted personnel to do the job that had to be done. In September of 1941, I apparently passed out at my desk in the Chemical Warfare Service headquarters, which was at that time at 23rd and D Street, Northwest in Washington, the present site of the State Department, and was carted off to Walter Reed, where my illness, which was probably complete exhaustion, was diagnosed as pneumonia, and I remained in Walter Reed for 6 weeks. While there, General Porter called on me and asked me what I would like to do when I was through with hospitalization. And I said that my dearest wish was to leave office duty and get some kind of field duty. He pointed out that I was too old for field duty, but that I could be a staff officer, provided that I could successfully complete the command and general staff course then being given at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. When I got out of the hospital, General Porter took me with him for a weekend to visit the commanding general at Leavenworth, General Trudeau. And after some discussion there, it was decided that I would be given an opportunity to make the grade, it being borne in mind that I had had no military experience whatever, but had come to the Army fresh from being a lawyer and immersed in business, mainly financial business. By way of preliminary indoctrination, I went to the Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland headquarters of the Chemical Warfare Service, and spent about 5 weeks deeply immersed in training films, film training, field training, and all the things which a relatively new recruit would do, a cram course second to none. I then entered at Leavenworth sometime in December 1942 for the December course, which lasted until April of 1943, and by great good fortune managed to survive the course and to graduate acceptably. This was quite a feat for me. Indeed, it was one of the toughest experiences in terms of hard-packed, unbelievable work day and night, 7 days a week, that I'd ever undertaken in my life. The practice at Leavenworth was to order those officers who had not completed the course satisfactorily off the base the night before. And this was such a traumatic experience that Leavenworth had experienced the number of suicides among officers who didn't make it. And the way in which the passing grade was achieved was by determining how many staff officers the Army needed, then drawing the line under that number and eliminating the rest. In my case, in my class, it split 80% needed, 20% not needed. Upon graduating Leavenworth, I was appointed as assistant to the Chief of Operations of the Chemical Warfare Service under a very gifted officer, General Alden Waite, Brigadier General Alden Waite, who subsequently became a Major General and the Chief of the Service. And in that capacity, I traveled with General Waite in all of the European theaters of operation and in all of the Pacific theaters of operation, engaged in planning major operations which had not yet occurred, but which would occur 6 months thereafter. We went wherever there was going to be a major operation in the ensuing 6 months. For example, I went to Europe September of 1943 with General Waite in the convoy called Cossack, which took General Arnold and his headquarters staff over to set up headquarters in London as a preliminary to the June 1944 invasion of Europe and with a code name Operation Overlord, our mission being to plan in connection with that operation, which was to take place some 9 months thereafter. On this same trip, I also went with General Waite for the same purpose to General Eisenhower's headquarters, which were then in Algiers, engaged in the same responsibilities. And similarly, went into the Army in Italy, then under the command of General Mark Clark, through the port of Sorrento in order to further engage in this planning and also to inspect 4.2 mortar units of the Chemical Warfare Service then in action on the Rapido River. Two personal experiences in that respect might be worth recalling. One is that I had last seen Capri in 1927, when I made a very extensive trip through Europe as a student, just before being admitted to the bar, or just after being admitted to the bar. I again saw it in 1943 from the belly of a B-25 bomber while a dogfight was going on over the Naples airport. And that was the last time up to now that I'd seen Capri. In another very tragic experience, General Waite and I went out to visit the officers' staff of a field battalion using the 4.2 mortar, also of the Chemical Warfare Service, commanded by a fine young lieutenant colonel whom we called Dolly, a nickname Dolly Stark, S-T-A-R-K. We had a fine luncheon with them and a fine visit. There was considerable firing of what they described as German 88s going on in the area, but it was a relatively quiet day on the Rapido River. The drive back to Naples took about an hour and a half. When we got back to Naples to our hotel room, the phone was ringing. And the message was that after we had left, a direct hit was scored on the camouflage tent in which we had had lunch, and Colonel Stark and his whole staff were killed. An unbelievable denouement, but unhappily for all mankind, not uncharacteristic of engaged in the same mission in the Pacific, leaving with General Waite sometime in the summer of 1944, and going through Saipan, Tinian, and Guam in the Pacific, moving into other islands of the Pacific, both for planning purposes, as I have described, and also to inspect units of the firing the 4.2 mortar, and finding my way ultimately to Bougainville, where a very prominent New Yorker was the chemical officer, Colonel Harold Riegelman, who had a marvelous war record, subsequently a Republican candidate for mayor of New York, and then going into New Guinea, General MacArthur's headquarters, and touring that whole area, doing our job, until I finally had 2 weeks as close akin to paradise as I will ever get, of rest and recreation in Australia, visiting Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. And though Australia was on the most strict kind of food rationing and transportation rationing, the girls were as beautiful as ever. Sydney Harbour, with its coat hanger bridge, as glorious as anything one could imagine, and the koala bears, cuter than anything I had yet seen. That is, of course, in the animal kingdom. Returning from the Pacific in late 1944, I was again stationed for a time in Washington on the same duty which I had had ever since getting out of Leavenworth. Leavenworth Command and General Staff School. And then in April of 1945, I was assigned to be an observer at the United Nations founding conference in San Francisco, in view of the fact that it was expected that there might be an effort to revise the Geneva Treaty, to which the United States was a party, relating to chemical and biological warfare. While there, attending the conference and the observer status, I was privy to much of the profound negotiation which went on, particularly under the auspices of the American Jewish Committee, represented by Joseph Proskauer of New York and Blank of Baltimore, which succeeded in writing into the Charter the human rights protections, which have been one of its finest achievements ever since. Also, I had the opportunity of observing at work both Ed Stettinius, the U.S. Secretary of State, who died at such a young age, not too many years thereafter, and Alger Hiss, who came to such a sad and tragic end after such a brilliant beginning in a career. After V-Day, it was seen clear that my work in the Army was over, and it was generally recognized that I would soon be demobilized, as indeed I was in September of 1945. Upon being demobilized, I returned to New York, uncertain as to what I should do, but once I arrived, it became very clear to me that no longer would I find any satisfaction in the practice of law, the trying of cases, but that what I had seen in war, in terms of the suffering and danger of others, and I had seen the trains of the wounded, the results of battle, the mowing down of whole forests of marvelous woodlands in all parts of the world by our own very 4.2 mortar, the operation of U.S. gun crews in action. The terrible tragedies, one of which I just related, of the Rapidore River and other bloody battles. The sea of mud in which 90,000 men lived at a place at a base called Finchhoven in New Guinea. And generally the rigors of war that I simply could not, at my then age, which was 41, bring myself to any other life than that of trying, if I could, to make some contribution to the avoidance of war or to the establishment of the rule of law over the rule of force. I realized that considering such talents as I had, this could only come to me through political life. And so